Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 26th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Prox, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zach Lawhorn with the LIO, and we have standing in today Jesse Logan, my staff, and temporary committee aide for House Labor and Commerce. We have five bills on today's agenda in House Labor and Commerce. We'll have first bill hearings on SB 55 from Senator Wilkowski, HB 91 from Representative McCabe, HB 119 from House Rules, and HB 150 from my office. We will then end the meeting discussing amendments on HB 149 from Representative Prox. Starting with SB 55 from Senator Wilkowski, please approach the table, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation. Oh, and sorry, let the record reflect that Representative Sadler and Representative Wright arrived at 3:16 p.m.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Wilkowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage. I'm joined by Mercedes Colbert, my Chief of Staff. This bill extends the sunsets for two boards, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives and the State Medical Board. The most recent legislative audit of the State Medical Board found they effectively licensed physicians, osteopaths, and podiatrists. However, emergency courtesy licenses for physician assistants were not issued in accordance with state law during the COVID-19 pandemic. This was remedied in November 2021 when corrective action was taken by sending letters to the noncompliant licensees. Furthermore, the board developed and adopted regulations to protect the public, improve licensing process, and expand access to care for during the COVID-19 public health emergency. As a result of these successful implementations, the Division of Legislative Audit proposed in July 2022 that the legislature extend the State Medical Board's termination date to June 30, 2031, which is the maximum extension allowed per statute. In the Senate Finance Committee, and that's the original bill that was filed, the Senate Finance Committee added the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives to this bill as an extension, since they were about to expire as well. Both of these boards are set to expire this year. The most recent legislative audit of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives found the board operated in the public's interest by conducting its meetings in an effective manner by supporting statutory changes when deemed necessary and actively amending regulations. The audit also concluded that the Board of Division and Division of Corporation Business and Professional Licensing staff did not consistently certify midwives in accordance with statutes and regulations and expressed concern that a threat to public safety was not addressed effectively. As a result of these findings, the Division of Legislative Audit proposed in October 2022 that the Alaska Legislature extend the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives termination date to June 30, 2027, which is half the 8-year maximum allowed by statute. The reduced extension reflects the need for more timely oversight. We have Chris Curtis here, who's the legislative auditor, and she is prepared to answer questions in detail that you might have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. And it looks like we have a Linda Day, not Chris Curtis online. Is that? Yeah. So
I think Chris Curtis is here.
Oh,
Chairman.
Sorry. My apologies. In person. Questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Prox.
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. Refresh my memory, I guess. Are there two levels of midwives essentially licensed by the state?
Hi. For the record, my name is Mercedes Colbert, staff to Senator Wilkowski. I would defer to Ms. Curtis, if I may.
I was hoping that we would have Ms. Curtis available to answer that.
Yes. We do. She's in the room.
We're in line. All right, good.
Ms. Curtis, if you'd like to address that question.
Okay. For the record, this is Chris Curtis, State Legislative Auditor. If you turn in the audit report to page 5, you're going to see the actual licenses that are issued, and there is an apprentice license and there's a direct entry midwife license. So there's no different license for any type of different type of midwife. Through the chair, are you thinking that there's an education versus an experience type of route to certificate?
I think I might be thinking about that there's a more formal education required. Over the years, there's, what was her name, Vicki Penwell, started the midwife businesses movement, I guess, in Fairbanks. And now there's just a few people practicing at that level in homes, mm-hmm. going to homes. And then there's another kind of branch. It's evolved to birthing centers. And are they licensed differently?
Representative Prax, to the chair, there are nurse midwives that are actually licensed by the Board of Nursing.
Yes.
And then there's direct entry midwives, which is this particular board.
What I'm thinking. Okay, very good. Thank you for clearing that up.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? Yes. Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, I am looking at the audit in recommendation 2 and just says that we need to improve the recruitment and retention of licensing staff. And I'm just wondering if Ms. Curtis could elaborate on that. What are some of the challenges to recruiting and retaining licensing staff currently?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, that recommendation and recommendation 1, which is to improve the recruitment and retention of investigative staff, mm-hmm. Was made because of the errors we found when testing. And what we're finding is recruitment and retention is a pervasive problem across state government, and so we believe it should be addressed at a statewide policy level. What those problems are, I think that's a question for the executive branch, but I can say that we are finding more and more often the cause of audit findings is vacancy, it's turnover, it's an inability to hire.
And just a follow-up.
Go ahead.
Looking at the, and this may be a question for the administration, so feel free to not provide an answer, but is a challenge with recruitment and retention partially due to salary of these investigative and licensing professionals?
I would have to defer that to the department.
Okay.
Chair, would you like me to go through the audits, or are we...
I mean, we do have them, so.
Okay.
Does anybody have any other further questions? Okay, we will set SB 55 aside for a future hearing where we will take public testimony, entertain amendments. I think there probably won't be many or any, and for potential passing. Thank you. And thank you, Senator Wilkowski and staff. Next, we have HB 91 from Representative McCabe. Representative McCabe, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Sumner and members of House Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for hearing HB 91. For the record, I'm Kevin McCabe, representative for House District 30. With me, I have my staff, Buddy Witt, who is available to walk through the sectional and summary of changes if the committee would like at some point. So this is a bill introduction. It's a relatively simple bill. HB 91 just brings the state of Alaska into line with JNSB, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. It modifies a few provisions governing the authorizations of the dedication of monies from the paycheck of public employees for the benefit of public labor or employee organizations. It implements a process to ensure that an employee's unequivocal consent to payroll deduction for union dues and fees is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. It provides the employee a regular opt-in period to provide their consent to waive their First Amendment rights. Consent renewed on an annual basis ensures that consents do not become stale, guaranteeing that the public employees have timely evidence of affirmative consent to deductions from all employees. As you will hear today from our invited testimony, this bill seeks to protect an employee's First Amendment right in their choice to either pay a union or not. That pretty much sums up the bill. Once again, my staff is available for to run through the sectional if you'd like, and I have invited testimony online.
Representative McCabe, I don't see online your invited testimony. Looks like you have a Mark Janis and a Vincent Vernuccio.
That would be them, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Is there Vincent is online? Mr. Vernuccio, sorry if I got that wrong. If you can hear me, you could begin your invited testimony now. Mr. Vernuccio, if you can hear me, please put your name on the record and begin your invited testimony on HB 91. Okay. Well, I think we will move on. My apologies, Representative McCabe, but we will at this time move on to the next bill, and if you'd like to contact your invited testimony, we can bring you up next.
Okay. Thanks. Through the chair, or to the chair, we had some issues with this position yesterday with the phone calls and in the invited testimony. So
in this room?
Yes.
Oh. Okay.
So could be that. Maybe they fixed it. I don't know. But you want to?
Let's take a brief at ease. We do have a CS for this bill. Representative Ruffridge, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I would move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 91, work draft 33.LS0499/B as the working document.
Okay, without objection, the committee substitute for House Bill 91 has been adopted as the working draft document, and we will Mr. Vernuccio, if you are online, please begin your invited testimony and put your name on the record.
Yes, thank you. My name is Vincent Vernuccio, and I'm a senior policy advisor with Workers for Opportunity. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify here today. At Workers for Opportunity, we rise in support of HB 91 and making sure that public employees across the state of Alaska are given an annual opportunity to choose whether or not they want to pay union dues and stay members of a union or not. This open enrollment empowers public employees across the state not only to know about their rights, but also to exercise them on an annual basis. We are seeing bills across the country affecting the ability of public employees to choose to pay dues. Tennessee, Arkansas, and most recently, literally 3 hours ago in Florida, have all passed bills that actually say that the government should not be the bills collector for union dues. This bill does not do that. It doesn't go that far. It simply says that in order to make sure that public employees are aware of their First Amendment rights as articulated in the Giannis versus Acme case, that they are given an annual opportunity to choose to pay dues or not. In fact, this concept of what the Biden administration's Federal Trade Commission has in a current notice of proposed rulemaking called a negative option is saying that once you sign up for a service, that sign-up should not last forever. And even the Biden administration, in the context of consumer protection, is saying similar arguments to the proponents of this bill, that people need to be given an annual opportunity. Just like we have open enrollment for health insurance and other services, there should be this type of open enrollment for union dues. And it should not be that a public employee gets a mountain of paperwork and is signing things on their first day, may sign a union card, may sign a dues checkoff agreement, not fully be aware of their rights, not be fully informed of their rights, and then that card is used to deduct dues from the paycheck for the rest of their career. This bill is about good bookkeeping. It's about protecting the First Amendment rights of public employees. It's about making sure that they have signed an agreement that they are aware of their rights and they are given that periodic opportunity. So I thank Representative McCabe and I thank the committee, and I'm also happy to take any questions.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bonuccio, I confess I had a difficult time understanding your statement. If you have it in written form, I'd appreciate if you could send that to the committee so we could read the information you had to share with us. And if you do testify first, I'm not sure if you can get closer to a microphone or take off a speakerphone or something like that.
Absolutely. I am sorry. Is this better?
Marginally, yes. Thank you.
And then Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, haven't heard of Workers for Opportunity before, but I looked at your website and it looks like a very large and well-funded organization. I was just curious who is funding it. Thank you.
We are a 501c3, and as with all 501c3s, our donors are confidential. However, we do get funding from donors across the country as well as foundations.
Through the chair, I might just wonder if the testifier could answer the question. Thank you.
But once again, our donations are confidential. We are a 501c3, and we do get donations from donors across the country, both individual and foundation.
Thank you.
Any other questions? No? Okay, thank you, Mr. Bernuccio. And then we have a Mark Janis. Mr. Janis, please put your name on the record and begin your invited testimony.
Hi, thank you. Yes, my name is Mark Janis, and that's spelled J-A-N-U-S. And I was the lead plaintiff in Janis v. AFSCME, which had a Supreme Court decision that was issued June the 28th of 2018. Case number 16-1466.
Okay.
Members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today in favor of this House Bill 91. And I'd like to applaud the effort of Representative McCabe and McKay to allow union members the opportunity to make their own decision regarding union membership. House Bill 91 should be approved. I heartily endorse the provision that allows employees to make their own decision annually regarding their dues authorization. As stated by Justice Alito in his opinion on my case, I quote, "Accordingly, neither an agency fee nor any other form of payment to a public sector union may be deducted from an employee, nor may any other attempt be made to collect such a payment unless the employee affirmatively consents to pay." Now, this is a definite improvement over the current situation and follows the intent of Justice Alito's opinion. And as Thomas Jefferson famously put it, to compel a man to furnish contributions of money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Now, by providing the employee a 60-day window prior to July 1, this effectively provides a reauthorization on paying dues for those that wish to support the union and what it collectively bargains for. Many employees just simply do not understand that they can resign or go to the trouble of resigning their membership. Many do not understand that by being a union member, they are giving up their First Amendment rights. How so? Well, it's very simple, because in the collective bargaining process and subsequent contract, the union is speaking for the employee, not the employee for themselves. And this was presented by Justice Alito in his decision. So resigning from union membership is difficult at best. I mean, I have seen firsthand the union squelching of employees' Janus rights, that it is now called. And Janus rights are not unlike Miranda rights. One should be made aware of what rights they have. Unfortunately, public sector unions do not believe in this basic right. Because this bill would require reauthorization every year prior to July 1, it would implicitly codify the idea of a one-year window, although it would be an opt-in window instead of an opt-out. In June, it will be the fifth anniversary of the Janus v. AFSCME Supreme Court decision. This momentous decision gave public sector workers the choice and the voice to decide for themselves whether joining a union and paying dues was right for them. Now, a lot has happened since that June 28, 2018 decision. Most prominent is the pushback of public sector unions to keep workers in the dark about their rights. House Bill 91 is a strong step in that right direction that we should be taking. And unions will oppose this step. Why? Well, maybe because they need to join the 21st century and represent employees in a different way. And I thank you.
Questions? Anybody? No? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Janus. Do any members of the committee have any other questions for the sponsor? No? Oh, Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I'm not sure if this is for Mr. Janus or the sponsor, but did the Janus decision require notification, annual notification? Was that the court's decision on that?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, through the chair, this is Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe. I believe that Mr. Venuccio would be able to answer that in full as to what the decision did specifically.
Okay, thank you.
I think he may have dropped off.
I'm happy to answer. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go ahead, Mr. Venuccio.
Yes. So Justice Alito referred to affirmative consent, and it is informed affirmative consent. In fact, I believe there is a Attorney General opinion that talks about the affirmative consent and waiving of First Amendment rights and waiving of constitutional rights, similar to what Mr. Janus was speaking about, as those waivers of rights can expire. So I believe that was an Attorney General opinion from about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay. Representative Fields?
Thanks, through the chair. Mr. Venuccio, I don't think you're from Alaska, but that Attorney General has been long, opinion has been long since invalidated by the court system, just as an FYI.
I do believe it's still being litigated in the court system.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the question to Mr. Janus still in order?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Mr. Janus, if you can hear me, sir. Thank you. Yes, sounds like you're on. You had said in your testimony.
I'm on.
Sure. You had said in your testimony, sir, that public sector union members would argue against essentially the position that you advocated in your Supreme Court case. What's the most common objection that you have heard made to the arguments that you've you asserted and won on in the Supreme Court?
Well, I think the biggest argument is that the unions are getting away from actually representing their membership in a true fashion when it comes to wages, benefits, and other efforts. The union has strayed from their core responsibility in bargaining and collective bargaining, and have gone off in so many other directions that they're leaving their membership behind. And, you know, members are trying to, you know, understand what this direction is, and many of them can't, so they just decide that they want to leave. However, the unions do a major pushback and produce all kinds of nefarious ways. I have talked to union members across the country in the last 4.5+ years, and I cannot even begin to tell you some of the nefarious ways that unions are keeping this information from people so they do not know their rights and they do not get the ability to express their First Amendment rights in resigning from the union.
Representative Sadler, follow.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Janus, I'm not sure if I made my the point of my question real clear. In the case that you were a plaintiff in before the U.S. Supreme Court, what was the argument made in opposition to your position?
What was the argument in the opposition?
Yeah. Those who opposed, well, what was their argument?
Well, the opposition was because they had already been decided by the Abood case previously, which was overturned by the Supreme Court, and that the Abood decision said that you could force people to pay some kind of a dues or agency fee, whatever you want to call it, and it was wrongly decided, and so therefore it got overturned. Of course, the unions don't like it because they like that idea of having to treat many of their memberships like an ATM machine, of which I was one.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Janus. You just described that the union takes part in many nefarious activities in order to keep their members. And without maybe going into all of the different aspects of that, can you provide us a singular example?
Oh, absolutely. I have heard from individuals that have called the union office and said, I would like to resign from the membership. And so the union says, okay, if you'll send us a registered letter by a P.O. box XYZ, you know, we'll get your, you know, get your resignation. Well, then what they don't know is that then they close down that XYZ post office box and they open up a separate and call 123. And then when the individual, you know, they're still having their dues removed from their payroll, and they contact the union and say, well, why hasn't my resignation been processed? The union says, oh, we never got your letter. That's just one example that I can provide.
Follow-up?
I represent Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Janus. Do you have data to share with us on how frequent that particular practice is?
Not actual data, but I do have, I mean, this is all one-on-one conversations with individuals when I travel around the country and meet various union people, and they advise me of what's going on.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Speaking of that, Mr. Janus, what are you doing for work these days?
Currently, I am employed by Liberty Justice Center, which is a public interest law firm. In this particular case and testimony, I'm definitely testifying on my own behalf and not representing anyone else but myself.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we will set this bill aside. Thank you, Representative McCabe and staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I might, there is a new fiscal note coming for this based on some information I got about an hour ago, so I will get that to you and your committee members as soon as I get it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative McCabe. Moving on to House Bill 119, a bill by request of rules. My staff, Jesse Logan, has been working on this. I'm going to have him approach the table with Cody Rice from the Speaker's office. Please put your names on the record and begin the presentation.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Cody Rice, staff to Speaker Tilton.
Thank you, committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Logan, staff to Representative Sumner. Today we are looking at House Bill 119, which is a marijuana tax reform bill, and you should have in your packets a proposed CS. I want to remind the committee that the original bill was before you a few weeks ago with preliminary changes to the tax structure of marijuana and the fund outputs. Before I get into the summary of changes, I'm going to give you a quick background on the urgency of this bill. Last year, Governor Dunleavy created a task force on recreational marijuana to review various parts of the industry and provide specific recommendations. Those recommendations were public in January and later refined to a number one priority in March as tax reform. The Alaska Marijuana Control Board agreed in a vote of 4-1 to provide immediate tax relief because Alaska has the highest functional marijuana tax in the nation, and market modeling shows significant delinquency in marijuana taxes, shrinking tax base, job loss, and near-term potential for industry catastrophe. Currently, marijuana is taxed at $50 per ounce by the cultivator. The control board unanimously agreed that the short term should be reduced by 75% to a $12.50 per ounce tax, and a long-term solution on better places a taxable transaction at the retail level in the form of a sales tax. It should be noted that the public health member of the control board believes any changes in taxation should be revenue neutral because the excise tax supports a number of programs important to public health and safety, which have to be paid then from other funding sources or the general fund directly. Now, initial modeling done by the Department of Revenue, as shown in the fiscal note that you have in your packet, suggests a reduction of excise tax from $50 to $12.50 an ounce, with an 18-month switchover to a 3% sales tax, would see marijuana tax revenue significantly decrease, a forecasted loss of close to $118 million over the next six fiscal years. If that's correct, it is a functional reduction of around 75% tax revenue. This places a large burden on programs from positive youth development, after-school programs, the Council on Domestic Violence, and Sexual Assault Prevention. However, without significant tax relief, the industry has the possibility of collapse, which only further threatens these programs with a dwindling tax base. I'd like to remind the committee that this bill is not about revenue. This bill is not focused on the programs either. This bill is about finding a middle ground that both supports the industry that should be thriving, as well as maintaining a reasonable benefit to the state. With that goal in mind, the numbers you see in the tax bill are a starting point for negotiation. The House majority has provided Cody Rice, who's sitting next to me, his service as an economic modeler to help us understand the market tax reform implications. If it pleases the committee, I can walk you through the summary of changes, or we can have the presentation by Mr. Rice. Following that, we have invited testimony by the co-chair of the Governor's Task Force, Jana Welton, and Ryan Tunseth, the president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association.
Mr. Logan, why don't you go through the summary of changes, and then maybe we'll entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute.
Section 2 of Version A has been deleted. This section allowed the department to set different rates of excise tax for different parts of the marijuana plant. Removing this section sets excise tax of $12.50 per ounce for all parts of the plant. This is repealed in Section 7 of Version B on January 1st, 2025, is the same date as the sales tax is implemented. Section 3 of Version A has been deleted. It now appears in Section 2 of Version B. This section has changed how the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund revenue was used and for what purposes. In Version B of the bill, the fund remains the same, but clarifies that up to 50% of the annual balance of the fund may be appropriated to youth services grant programs within the community-based marijuana misuse prevention component of the program. Section 4 of Version A now appears in Section 3 of Version B. In Version A, this section had applied a 3% sales tax on marijuana retailers. In Version B, the sales tax is increased to 10%. This would take effect January 1 of 2025, the same date the excise tax is repealed. Section 7 of Version A has been deleted. That section repealed the Marijuana Recidivism Reduction Fund. Removing this section retains that fund, and the remainder of the changes are conforming, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ruffridge, do we have a motion to adopt the committee substitute?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move to adopt committee substitute for House Bill 119, Work Order 33-LS-0636-B, Bravo.
As our working document?
As our working document. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no objection, the committee substitute has been adopted as our working document. Mr. Rice.
Thank you.
Put your name on the record and proceed. Thank you.
My task today was to represent the economics of the proposed CS without regard to the policy. I'm happy to take questions at any time. I'll walk you through a couple of the key points and some of the key facts. So under the current statutes, there are grades of tax based on the category, $50 for bud, $25 per ounce for immature CD malformed, and $15 per ounce for trim. As my colleague has outlined, the changes are a flat tax of $12.50 per ounce for the next 18 months, followed by a 10% sales tax. That's what we've modeled here going forward. One of the things that I wanted to point out for the committee is that a switch to a price-based tax is consistent with the majority of other legal jurisdictions. Alaska is around the middle of the pack in terms of per capita tax revenue from legal marijuana. With that said, and consistent with the testimony from Mr. Logan, the tax paid on a hypothetical ounce of legal marijuana is higher in Alaska than any of the other jurisdictions that were tracked by the Urban Institute and Brookings Institution. In fact, the tax at $50 per ounce is roughly equivalent on a price per pound basis to what the wholesale price is reportedly in Colorado and Oregon, according to data that I've seen.
Representative Fields.
Can I ask a question on this slide, please, through the chair? So it looks like the slide is sort of aggregating per weight and sales taxes. And if that's the case, what is the median tax rate in terms of sales tax? Like, is 12.5%, does that end up near the median, or where is it relative to the median across the states? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, I'll have to take a look and get that to your office. The taxes vary from state to state, and making an equal comparison when some states tax on a milligram THC content, some tax on a price basis, and some tax on a combination or an excise tax basis like Alaska.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, for the chair, Mr. Rice. So help those of us who can't calculate that quickly. If the proposal of the bill is to go from the $50 per ounce to a $12.50 per ounce ceiling for all and a 10% sales tax, what's the net likely change in tax, I guess, per ounce? This is going from $50 per ounce down to what per ounce?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's a great question. The $50 nominal is the headline rate for the highest category of legal marijuana at this point in time. The realized or the effective tax rate that the Department of Revenue has reported based on historical sales has declined in every year. And the estimate from the model that I produced is that it will continue to decline going forward. And that is a function of the change in product mix. In other words, and we'll get into this in following slides, if that works for you. And please,
for the record, Jesse Logan, staff to Rep. Sumner. If I took your question right, I think that you meant the reduction percentage from $50 to $12.50 would be a 75% reduction.
Right, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. So what I'm trying to get is a basic sense. I'm not quite sure how the 10% sales tax and the $12.50 per ounce tax ceiling, what the net result of that is compared to the $50 per ounce for the top category.
Through the chair, the way this bill works is that there would be an immediate reduction in the excise tax.
Okay.
And then after 18 months, which is the amount of time that the Department of Revenue has told us it would take them to set up a sales tax system, then the excise tax would be eliminated, and at the same moment, the sales tax would be implemented. So it would be one or the other.
Okay. Trying to get to, Mr. Chair, just an idea of if it's going to go from $50 down to what per ounce?
In the immediate, on this bill, $12.50. Through the chair.
Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Sadler's questions made me realize that I don't understand the relative value of $12.50 per ounce or 10%, which is actually a higher tax rate.
It depends on the product mix.
Say product mix fixed at present, through the chair. Thank you.
I can take a look and pull up the model and give you an accurate year-by-year estimate.
Why don't we run through the presentation and then we'll take questions?
Sure.
Just so we're not duplicative.
So a couple of things to point out that may be useful for the committee in making these sorts of decisions is understanding that in legal jurisdictions, typically the price path for the commodity itself, for the price of cannabis, has declined over time. As I mentioned before, the current wholesale rate per pound in Colorado and Oregon is around $800 per pound, which is roughly equivalent to the tax rate in Alaska for bud alone. What we've seen in recent history, and what you can see on this chart, is a change in the product mix. So the green line is bud, which is taxed at $50 per ounce. The yellow line is trim, which is taxed at 15 per ounce, and the blue line is immature malformed CD, which is taxed at 25 per ounce. And you can see that there's been a rollover in the volume of bud, and the increase in immature and trim has been relatively linear. I did a simple econometric regression analysis here, and the suggestion is that the product mix will likely continue to diverge, and if that happens, then the realized or the weighted average tax rate that the state receives is likely to continue to go down. And if you look at the history, it started out as a weighted average tax rate of $31 per ounce, and it's decreased every year through the most recent year. The economic model that I've put together is certainly not infallible, but it suggests that next year the weighted average realized tax rate per ounce will be $26, and it will continue to decline from there. I've modeled this out here. The model as it is now assumes a floor of $19 per ounce as a minimum for the tax rate. Going forward, this is what that revenue profile looks like. And the uptick, as you see that linear uptick, is when the increase in consumption that is implied by the trim and immature finally overtakes the change in the product mix that you're seeing that's causing the downslope in revenues. This is different than the Department of Revenue's forecast. Specifically, it shows a bottoming out of revenue over the next 3 years of approximately $9 million less than last year. Using the assumptions that I came up with for the economic models going forward, even at a lower growth forecast for the market, this bill would generate more revenue than the current status quo. I'm happy to answer any questions about the specifics of the model.
Yep. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I just have a basic question, too. According to this chart, in the most recent year we had, FY22, there were about just under 500,000 ounces of bud and maybe 300,000 ounces, I'm sorry, of trim, 350,000 ounces of bud, and about 250,000 ounces of immature. I can't do the math real quick, but I'm just trying to understand how much marijuana is being sold. On your food, you have a serving size. I'm not quite sure how many servings, for lack of a better word, there are in 1 ounce of marijuana, and just how much marijuana is legally being circulated in Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler,
I
think your mileage may vary. It might be the appropriate answer.
Well, mileage here.
The economic model, if you want, I can actually show you what the assumption is in terms of ounces per capita consumed in Alaska on a year-by-year basis. If you'd like to see that, we can walk through that.
If we're going to get to that in a bit, sure. I'll wait for it then.
Okay. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I think that kind of gets to Representative Sadler's question, kind of gets to a question I have, which is, are we expecting the amount of marijuana consumed in Alaska and subject to the tax to go down, or are we expecting just the prices to drop?
This model doesn't actually currently assume dynamic price responses. I've looked at the price elasticity of demand in other legal markets. It's reasonable to assume that it is a relatively elastic good, meaning if you change the price, you will see a response, although it's not unitary elastic, which would be a one-to-one.
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So you're saying if we lower the price of it, there'll be more consumption.
through the chair, Representative Wright. That's correct, although I can't tell you whether that increased consumption will come from taking market share from the black market or whether that will actually be increased consumption on an individual by individual basis. Okay. Generally speaking, the data that I've seen for Oregon and Colorado on price elasticity of demand suggested that there is a response in terms of consumption to price.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Mr. Rice, I suppose, where was the, through the chair, where was the $50 per ounce tax established? Who set that rate?
Staff to Jesse Logan, staff to Jesse Sumner. Through the chair, that was established in the Citizens Initiative that first decriminalized marijuana in 2015.
Okay. So the people that voted for legalization and set this tax rate?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm afraid I don't know much about the marijuana industry, don't know the difference between bud and trim and the rest of it. And I guess there's two things that I'm interested in. One is lowering or eliminating the black market would be one goal. And the other would be maximizing the state's revenue. And that isn't, you couldn't raise the tax up to $150 per ounce or whatever it is. That wouldn't work. So is your model trying to figure out the optimum tax rate that maximizes state value without hurting the consumption enough to go backwards? There was a green line that looked like it took a turn, and that's where the state started losing revenue. Yes, on that chart. And that is for bud, I guess. And is it true then that the lower quality consumption is going up and the bud being the higher quality is going down?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I think there were a couple of things there to address, and I'll take them in order with the chair's permission.
Go ahead.
The first question in terms of market share and price response. This model does not currently take dynamic changes in consumption into effect. That's something that I'm happy to consider at a later date, and I'm happy to also run scenarios for your office or your staff at any time. In terms of user preferences and consumption, I don't think we can answer that from this data, but I think what we can say from the data that exists here is that it appears that rational economic responses are occurring to tax policy, which is selling a product that is taxed at half or less of a similar product appears to be going on. And you're seeing what's called in the retail sector a change in the product mix in response to the tax policy.
Okay. So follow up. So at some point, will you be trying to run a model that, it's kind of like oil tax, you want to squeeze as much as you can out of them without driving the business to somebody else? Are we going to assume that the 1250 is that point, or are we going to refine that and maybe find a lower or higher tax rate that optimizes the state's revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, we're going to hear in a few moments from the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association as well as the co-chair of the governor's task force, and I think that they can probably better answer how they arrived at those numbers. But I do want to remind the committee that we have the highest functional marijuana tax rate in the country, and that puts this industry in direct competition with the black market. It's making it very difficult for a lot of these businesses to stay afloat.
Representative Sadler.
Just for education, through the chair, what is the current legal price of 1 ounce of the different levels of marijuana products or levels of material, the bud versus immature versus trim? Not the tax rate, but what is the legal price?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I would say it's whatever the market will bear.
Give me some examples, please.
But the prices that I've seen range from around 260. I think that's the average implied price per ounce based on tax revenues, reported tax revenues. I think it was 260 per ounce, but there's quite a bit of variation, and I'm sure folks from the industry can give you specific examples.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Thank you, through the chair. And is that for one level or for all levels average, that $260 average per ounce?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that $260 per ounce is an average of all ounces combined, divided by the revenue that's been reported for the jurisdictions that report it.
Thanks. And I think with that, we'll actually take invited testimony from Ryan Tunseth at the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. Mr. Tunseth, if you can hear me, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Okay, good afternoon, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, Chair Sumner, and my representative, Vice Chair Ruffridge. For the record, my name is Ryan Tunseth. I'm the president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. I also own and operate a small retail marijuana business in Kenai called East Rip, and I reside in Kenai, Alaska with my wife, Heidi, and our three kids. As an advocate for the industry, I'm here today to express support for tax reform. I want to thank the committee for holding this hearing today and providing the opportunity to speak on this issue. You know, our industry is small, but it's an important part of Alaska's economy, providing jobs and generating tax revenue for the state. And our success is dependent on a fair and reasonable tax structure that supports the growth and sustainability of all of our businesses. And currently, we don't feel like our industry is on very stable footing. Without immediate tax relief, many of our cultivation businesses will fail. There's currently over $3 million in delinquent taxes. And we feel that changing to a tax collection point at retail will greatly reduce, if not eliminate, future delinquencies. There are some concerns from our industry, and not everyone is in full support of this. I'll try to outline what I believe to be the concerns, as well as the areas that we have agreement. One of the areas that we have agreement is that immediate relief is needed now, and that without drastic reductions, we're just not able to compete with black and gray markets, as you heard Cody and Mr. Logan do a very good job of explaining. You know, a cost of pound spot price in Alaska is around $2,500, and when you compare that to Oregon, it's about $800. When you look at the pound of oil, a concentrated product in Alaska being somewhere around $9,000 to $12,000 a pound versus $3,000 to $4,000 in Oregon and Washington. What all of this sort of spells is that there's arbitrage happening, and it's very difficult for us to compete with this price floor that's, you know, the highest in the nation. We also felt like 3% was a very good number. At 10% or higher at the retail, we have a lot of industry resistance. But we felt like 3% was one that would, you know, stand up over time and was supported throughout the industry, and would also be able to address the externalities that we felt were fair to place on the sale of an intoxicating product. Another thing that we would like to see included is the opportunity for quarterly payments versus monthly payments. As you guys know, there's only one Dropbox to currently remit taxes, and because of the banking situation in our industry, many of us, if not all of us, operate only in cash. And so making monthly trips to Anchorage from all over Alaska to drop off cash has been a huge burden on cultivators, and we would continue to see that be a burden on retailers. And so we would love it if you would entertain providing for a quarterly payment option. Another concern that's been brought up from both municipalities and retailers in rural municipalities is that if you would entertain a cap or something on the tax rate, that would also take into account what might be very high local percentage tax. So, for instance, in Bethel, I believe they have a 15% sales tax already. And so if there was some way to quantify a cap that would prevent the tax from going over a certain number in combination with a local tax. you know, I think this represents a really necessary and important step towards, you know, making this industry more sustainable. And it's really a right time. You know, we've been talking about this for a long time, as you guys know, within our industry, but also seeing the growing tax delinquency list. And so it's ripe for opportunity to change, and it's smart that you guys are looking at this. You know, if it's currently, as it's written, problematic, you know, I would really urge that you look at the immediate tax relief piece for cultivators that's outlined in this bill, and perhaps just include that with the sunset date, because very much so our cultivators are hurting, and we know it. And so I would urge that you would support immediate relief now if you can. Finally, you know, a little bit unrelated but related, while House Bill 117, which was cannabis reform, included some controversial cannabis provisions, switching to biennial licensing was not one of them. And so it would be wise to consider folding in language that would allow for biennial licensing into this bill if possible. This was fully supported by the EMCO office and the Marijuana Control Board and would represent a significant administrative cost savings and reduce the burdens currently on the employees in the EMCO office. So I'm available for more questions. I really appreciate you taking the time. I have a deep respect for your service to our state. I just want to express my sincere gratitude for your station. I offer up our association to help in whatever capacity you require. I'm honored to have the ability to speak with you today, and I remain available now or in the future for additional questions.
Thank you. Questions? No? Okay. We have Jana Weltzen, co-chair of the Governor's Task Force on Recreational Marijuana. Mrs. Weltzen, if you could please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Sumner and Co-Chair Ruffridge. My name is Jana Weltzen, and I'm currently the co-chair of the Advisory Task Force on Marijuana that was established by the Honorable Governor Dunleavy. I'm also a founding member of AMIA, and I own a law firm in town that represents hundreds of marijuana licensees. So the task force was formed in September 2022, and it got to work and started working, kind of hit the ground running on the governor's request. And he asked us to look at a few things. The governor specifically asked us to model potential tax changes that were applicable to the marijuana, recreational marijuana industry, and to note potential models that might have impacts on state and local governments in regards to their current tax collection, and then identify opportunities to foster collaboration between recreational marijuana businesses and state government. And third, to analyze, and this is in front of you today, the recreational marijuana program and the industrial hemp program for the purposes of providing safety recommendations. So the task force was made up of 13 individuals, all volunteers. It was made up of license holders, and also the Department of Revenue, the Division of Agriculture, both DNR and their appointee with the Division of Agriculture, the chair of the Marijuana Control Board, and members from the public, and then industry at large, and corporations division. So through our discussions and through our debates, we held weekly meetings, and we came up with, you know, I think it was like a 13-page, actually 18-page, very lengthy recommendations, and we kind of synthesize it down to one thing: taxes. Right now, our tax rate for a pound of wholesale marijuana is equivalent to how much you can buy it for on the unregulated black market. So in the state of Alaska, we've had marijuana long before the voters voted to legalize it. And right now, you can go and buy a pound of marijuana from the unregulated, untested, untaxed market for about what we pay in taxes. And that's an issue for us, right? Because these are complex jobs that are being created. They're jobs for young people that young people are excited about, because it's an industry that's growing throughout the nation. So many states are coming online, and they're looking for people that have experience not only with the plant, but with the regulatory system that goes with the legalization of marijuana. If you're a marijuana operator, your employees have to know how to operate Metric, if that's your state system, or a similar system like BioTrack or MJ Freeways. These are complicated regulatory systems. You also have to know about 90 pages of regulations. And so these are very complex jobs that people are learning new skills, they're getting diversified, and they're creating value in themselves. So it's a lot of economic activity. Like I mentioned, I represent a couple hundred marijuana licensees, all the way from, you know, manufacturers creating oil and edibles to cultivators to retailers. And our renewal deadline's coming up this year where folks have to file for renewals. I've had about 5 cultivators tell me, Jana, I'm closing up shop. I am not renewing my license. I cannot make it work. I have to let go of my employees. That's 5 Alaskan businesses. That's about 20 jobs that we just lost. And it's only April, and the deadline is June. So what we're talking about here is a transition tax. And so, you know, the task force recommended 3%. I understand that the committee has adopted the committee substitute that brings it up to 10%. And, you know, it's a good place to start the discussion. But what you have to understand is right now, all that's being taxed is the base product. So Representative Sadler has some really excellent industry questions that if any of them have not been answered, I'd be happy to circle back to. But the value-added products are not being taxed. So right now, only the raw agricultural plant is being taxed. The bud and flower, that's the top tier of the plant. It's got the most value. That's at $260, $250 an ounce sale price. The immature bud, the popcorn bud, the abnormal seeds bud, that's at $25 an ounce. That's what they were talking about. That's like your good like bud rolls, your pre-rolls, that type of stuff. That's your middle level. That's about $160 an ounce retail value. And then the trim is what you use to run through an extraction machine and produce that $9,000 to $12,000 a pound oil concentrate. That's the higher, that's that value added. We're not capturing any of the value added products in our current price system. Our current tax system. Our current tax system is essentially a static price floor that basically no other state has as even a, like, we are the price for other states' wholesale pound is our tax. And the same thing with the unregulated market. Once federal legalization happens, forget about competing with the unregulated market in Alaska. We won't be able to compete with any state out there if we keep this tax structure. And I really want to thank the committee and thank Chair Sumner's staff for working so hard on this. This industry, while I know that some people still have reservations about it, has brought on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of direct jobs and ancillary jobs, like my firm, like us CPA firms, architect firms, construction firms that have generated a lot of economic activity in a period where we've been kind of static as a state. So I really thank you for your thoughtful consideration of this bill and discussing it. I'm here for any questions or any follow-up thoughts that you may have.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Waltzien. I really appreciate your testimony today, and I'm just, from your perspective, curious with this CS we've just adopted, the 10% tax as opposed to what was initially proposed. What impacts do you potentially foresee this will have on consumer behavior? I think that was sort of the question a few of us were trying to ask, and we were getting sort of an economist's answer. I'm curious what you're
hearing. Yeah. thank you. Through the chair, and thank you so much for the good question. So what I see that happen, if we keep it at 10%, here's the reality. A consumer is going to come to a shop, and if the price point that the shop offers is not lower than what they can get it from the unregulated market, they will go to the unregulated market. It's estimated that we still haven't captured 50 to 60% of the marijuana consumers in Alaska because they're going to unregulated, untested, untaxed market. So if the price is too high and the tax is too high, you will see consumers not shop at shops, and they'll just go back to their unregulated operators. And what I really get concerned about is the disproportional impact on rural communities, like Mr. Tunstead was speaking to. Bethel has 15% sales tax. If you put a 10% sales tax on that, that's 25%. That means it's going to be really difficult for folks out in Bethel to get clean, tested, regulated, taxed marijuana at a price that's feasible for them. Topsview has 6%, plus they pay the excise tax that matches the current state tax structure. That means it's going to be really, really difficult and expensive for folks out in Topsview to get tested marijuana at an affordable price. Thank you for the question.
Go ahead, Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Ms. Waltine, through the chair. And I recognize that it's going to be different depending on the retailer and the products being sold and the location the products are being sold. But with a 10% tax, is, in your opinion, is this enough to price out many or most consumers? Or kind of where does this proposed CS language fall in terms of actual market behavior?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. My taking off my co-chair hat, because the task force hasn't had a chance to consider this CS that just came out, I believe, either today or yesterday. And we have a meeting on Monday, so we're going to be discussing this. So taking off my co-chair hat, putting on my industry licensee lawyer hat, I think that this is not the magic number. I think this is going to be too high, because you have to remember, you know, looking at prices for retailers, you know, a gram of concentrate is $80. You add 10% onto that, that's $88 from a recreational store, and you can probably get it for cheaper. I know cheaper, but probably like 75, 70 from the black market. And, you know, we have to start thinking about this industry. If you want to keep it and we want to grow it and we want to capture more of the unregulated market, I know it's hard right now, but a revenue neutral is going to leave the industry at best stagnant and at worst hurt.
Any other questions? Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. It looks like we have two problems. The immediate problem of, if you will, keeping the industry going, or at least not hurting the industry too much through an excessive tax or an inappropriately applied tax. So we need to do something, if I understand you correctly, we need to do something immediately, which I guess would mean before the 21st of May. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Prax. I would say that is a fair statement. The industry has been begging, pleading, asking for a tax that's reasonable and rational and not, you know, 30 to 50% of what their gross income is. Because you also have to remember, these businesses, they're not taxed like regular businesses. They don't get to write off their regular business expenses because they're still federally illegal. So not to mention not having access to regular bank, like business tools, like banking, to make life easier. They can't write off their bud tender's time. They can't write off their accountant's time. They can't write off most of my time. They have to pay taxes on a net income figure that they simply didn't take in, if that makes sense. So this is compounded by the federal policies, which is not the state's fault, but it's just reality. And so we don't get relief on the state level, we will see a massive amount of businesses go out of business, and we'll lose jobs.
Well, Mrs. Welsen, it seems to me that if you had marijuana legal on the federal level and it was allowed to be shipped into Alaska, there may not be an Alaskan industry. I would presume that a total legalization of marijuana at the federal level would drive your margins down to about that of broccoli. And if you have a reason to believe differently, that it's not actually the bank's imposed capital investment restrictions and the restrictions on the shipping of the product from other states where it could potentially be growing substantially cheaper, I would like to hear those.
Well, through the chair, I mean, that's an excellent point. That's one of the things I always tell my clients is, you know, federal legalization could, and very likely demolish the production aspect of the industry, right? The production aspect, not the retail aspect, but the production aspect. Because, you know, retail level, hopefully our state would be wise enough to regulate it like alcohol and license things and make sure it's done, like not shipped to people's houses all the time and done in a regulated manner. But as the Division of Ag's members of the task force pointed out so smartly, there are ways that we can restrict or at least create value in our production industry from other states bringing plant matter in, because we have a sensitive, unique environment here. There are ways, like Hawaii does, to restrict agricultural products coming into the state. Now, not saying that that's always the magic answer, but there's ways to do it where we can still protect our thriving cultivation facilities, which, on another note, can help with food security if things went really off in the world, because they are built for production of agricultural goods. All these indoor facilities can quickly turn into food production.
Okay. Thank you. So seeing no other questions, I think we will set this bill aside for a future date to notice amendments and take public testimony. Next, we have House Bill 150 from my office. I'm going to have Chief of Staff Steve Menard present the bill. Mr. Menard, why don't you approach, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation.
While he's doing that, what is the schedule of past CMP's payday lending bill?
Take a brief at ease. Record, Mr. Menard, why don't you begin your presentation? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. For the record, I'm Steve Menard, Chief of Staff for Representative Sumner. Today I'm going to introduce House Bill 150, which is State Residential Building Code. Residential building codes are essential in ensuring the safety and well-being of individuals living in homes. This code will provide a set of guidelines that must be followed during the construction process to ensure that the structure is safe, secure, and habitable. The implementation of statewide residential building codes is critical. It helps prevent accidents such as fires, collapse, and other hazards that can cause harm to residents. Some may argue that building to a specific set of guidelines is too restrictive or costly for builders. But by requiring inspections and permits for construction projects, these codes ensure that a home is built to a standard, especially in Alaska's unique environment. It is essential that we have codes to put in place that are specifically designed to withstand seismic activity. In essence, the structures that are built with materials and techniques that can resist the forces of an earthquake. Building codes also help regulate the quality of construction materials used in homes. This ensures that only high-quality materials are used in the construction process, which improves the durability and longevity of structures. Additionally, building codes help ensure the homes are constructed with energy-efficient features, which can save homeowners money on utility bills. In conclusion, building codes play an essential role in ensuring the safety and well-being of individuals living in homes. It will provide guidelines for construction, design, and maintenance of residential buildings to ensure that they meet specific safety standards. By adhering to these regulations, we can create safer communities for everyone to live in. I urge you to consider HB 150, and if it's the will of the chair, I can go through the sectional analysis with you.
Sure. Mr. Menard, why don't you go through the sectional analysis, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Again, for the records, Steve Menard, Representative Sumner's office. Section 1 removes the term privately owned to apply to residential contractors endorsed to any residential structure within the scope of the state residential building code, whether publicly or privately owned. Section B adds a requirement of DCCED to test the contractor's knowledge of the state residential building code as part of the examination insurance of the residential contractor's endorsement. C, requires an applicant to submit proof of adherence to the state residential building code as a condition for renewal and reinstatement of a residential contractor's endorsement. Section 2 adds a new subsection, requires a residential contractor to comply with state residential building codes except when providing services to a building subject to another code adopted by a municipality or AHFC, which is Alaska Housing. Section 3 amends the definition of residential contractor to include an operation involved in construction alteration of a residential structure within the scope of the state residential building codes, whether publicly or privately owned. Section 4 under chapter regulation construction contractors and home inspectors add a new definition for state residential building code to mean the state residential building code adopted. Section 5 confirms amendments relating to the minimum standard of Alaska Housing to make purchase of a housing loan. Section 6, conforming amendments relating to Alaska Housing inspection of residential buildings for the purpose of purchasing or approving a loan. Section 7 amends the definition of state building code applicable to Alaska Housing, reflecting either the state residential building code adopted by DCCED in Section 8 or another nationally recognized residential building code adopted by Alaska Housing. Section 8 requires DCCED to adopt by regulation a national recognized residential building code as a state residential building code, allows DCCED to modify the code as necessary, states that its code will serve as a minimum standard for residential construction for residential dwellings and requires DCCED to administer the state residential building code. B, allows the municipality to adopt a nationally recognized residential building code to use in place of the state residential building code adopted under A and modify that code as necessary if the municipality determines that adoption is necessary to promote the best interests of the municipality. C, allows Alaska Housing to adopt a nationally recognized residential building code to use in place of the state residential building code adopted under A and modify that code if necessary, if Alaska Housing determines that adoption is necessary to carry out its duties and is the best interest of the state. D, subordinates in the minimum standard residential building code adopt under this section when in conflict with the status that govern other business codes. Section 9 is adds a new section to the uncodified law subjecting contractors to revise residential contracts endorsements and after the effective date of the act, and B, applying the code adopted in Section 8 to new buildings that are built on or after the effective date of the act, and 10 is the effective date, which you already have probably realized makes the act effective January 1, 2024, which is unrealistic. Needed to be changed in committee, whatever the committee deems appropriate. Other than that, I can answer some questions.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair. Several questions. First one is, are licensed residential contractors, are they required to follow the code now as part of the licensing requirement?
Through the chair, I'm going to take a stab at that. And I do have, just for the record, Dave Owens online and Eric Weiser, who's president of the Alaska Housing Building Association. But I think, through the chair, Representative Prock, I think what you're trying to ask, there are 12 municipalities right now that do have code. but there is no statewide residential code. So, for example, if you were a contractor in a municipality, and you would have to follow their code presently. But what this would do a minimum standard across the state. And then if there is a conflict between local and state, the local has preference. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
It sort of does. I'll go to the next one. And actually, this is mostly going on experience that's a couple of decades old now. But there were houses built within the city limits of North Pole, but they have a building code, and they were built to the minimum of the building code, and they're of lower quality in many instances than houses that were built in the borough outside of the city limits of North Pole, but within the borough. The contractors and the purchaser, I guess, agreed to a higher standard. And going way, way back when we built our house, that was a long time ago, but we read the national building codes and decided that wasn't appropriate for Alaska, and we built beyond the code to meet our needs. So one concern is that the code provides or could provide a false sense of assurance that you're getting a quality home as compared to just knowing your contractor. The banks seemed of late to be requiring homes within the borough outside of a city limit. They seemed to be requiring the home to be built to a code, and they did their own inspection or whatever assurance. So it seems to be working within the North Star borough well enough now, and I'm not sure that there's an advantage to establishing a code, that it's a false sense of assurance is one. And then the other, if it is a statewide building code, will the state have to hire building inspectors to enforce the code, or how is this going to be enforced in some practical way?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Prox. So right now, to answer your question, the de facto enforcement agency for the state of Alaska is Alaska Housing and Finance Corp, banks, or like you said, credit unions. So when you're getting financed, right, they're requiring you to meet certain building standards. And again, I don't want to get down the wormhole with you on this, because the process at this point was just going to be on the introduction, but I would love to get you those answers, because those are valid answers, and we're still working on that, is what is the teeth to this requirement. And but you're absolutely right. At the end of the day, it is your contractor's reputation and ability to, you know, that's on the line.
Mm-hmm.
But we're at least on the state side, we would have something on the books for litigation if there was, a major earthquake and they, you know, this home, some recourse. Does that make sense?
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Menard. I do see in Section 7 we say that to Representative Prox's question, we're changing the authority for enforcement from Department of Public Safety to DCCED. So I don't know if that's something to potentially comment on But my question was actually relevant to for the states that have adopted a statewide building code. My understanding is DCCED will have the authority to decide what that code will be and what standards we use. And I'm just curious, as someone who's not in the home building industry, is there a national standard that most states have adopted, a similar uniform national standard, or is there variation between states in the standards that get adopted?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Corrick, I'd love to defer this one. This, you're getting kind of the expertise. Eric, are you on the line there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, did you hear the question?
I am. Can you hear me?
Eric Visser, President of Alaska Homebuilders Association, why don't you just begin your presentation, Mr. Visser, and put your name on the record, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Visser. I am the president for the Alaska State Homebuilders Association and a homebuilder here in Anchorage. I'm calling in from Anchorage today. And yeah, thank you for the question through the chair, Representative Carrick. There is a model code. It's called the International Residential Building Code that states adopt, but there are a lot of states that do local amendments through committees, basically, of, you know, local building officials, inspectors, home builders. And getting back to Representative Krax's question about building to a code and having that those houses be some of, like, low-quality homes, that is true. If you build to the IRC in Alaska, it will not work. Some of their standards just don't work for the state. So there are local amendments that are required. AHFC goes through that process to update the IRC with local amendments. Anchorage Municipality goes through that process. So that is something that will definitely have to happen at the state level as well.
Thank you, Mr. Visser. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Menard, you said, I believe it was you that said that, that there are 12 municipalities that do have building codes. I don't know if I need the list of all the names, but what percentage of the state of Alaska, area-wise or population-wise, do those 12 cover? I mean, 12 sounds like a lot. It could be many, could be a little. Help me understand the how big that is.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, let me get you back. I don't want to misinform you. I think the percentage was 85%.
Oh, I haven't heard that. Okay, so 85% through the chair.
I would correct that. That is actually not a correct number, but we will get back to you on the correct number. I would know for certainty that the entire Matsu borough, with the exception of the city limits of Palmer, is... is outside of that, which is more than 15%. Representative Fields.
Thanks. I guess a question for the chair, maybe through the chair to Mr. Visser. Kind of elaborating on Representative Carrick's question. So what are our options in terms of where to house this DCCED? What are the other options? What's the thought on placing it in DCCED? And then in terms of updating the standards, is that best done in DCCED? Is a some kind of council-based structure the best way? If you could just talk through kind of how you came to that conclusion and why it's superior to the other options, that's certainly beyond my level of knowledge. Thank you.
Mr. Visser, if you heard the question, you could address that.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Fields, thanks for the question. There are definitely more than one option for where to house this code. We have been going back and forth on, you know, is it public safety? Is that the right place to house it? Or is it DCCED? But I think the format for updating the code and making local amendments is pretty standard throughout jurisdictions that already have adopted the code, where there's committees that are put together, you know, where there's, say, three home builders, two engineers, some inspectors, you know, where the committee has a certain number of people and they just get together and review the updates to the code and say what they want to keep and what they want to change for the state.
and then basically vote on it. And that's what goes forward. So I think that's going to get kind of sorted out here in the next, you know, whatever months to the next year. And we just kind of want the best fit for the state. I think really what this is from our perspective, it's a consumer protection mechanism, because right now there are people that, you know, if they're building a house and they hire a residential contractor, they don't really have any recourse to go back and say that this residential contractor didn't build their house to code, because currently there is no code if you're outside of the jurisdictions that do have one. Thank you for the question.
And if I might, just really quick, the Alaska Housing Finance also has the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, which has made substantial and very significant recommendations, and through their, and the only enforcement they have is through lending standards, but has significantly moved the standards for construction in this entire state, for energy efficiency at the very least. And so, yeah, Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, so through the chair to Mr. Visser, it sounds like you're telling me that the structures envisioned within DCCED, because of that industry participation, would ensure that the agency is sort of updated about best practices and the need to update the code because of the nature of that working group. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, yes, I'd say that's accurate.
Thank you.
And we also have Dave Owens with the Alaska State Home Builders Association. Mr. Owens, if you could put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today to the committee. I appreciate you bringing this forward. I feel like it's long overdue. We brought it to you about 2 years ago, maybe three. And, we just ran out of time, but I believe the committee was very interested in establishing a code. The unique thing about this one is, contractors are bringing this forward. It applies to licensed contractors in the state of Alaska. And, you know, I'm here today representing myself, but also representing the state, Alaska State Home Building Association, and they're bringing this forward, saying we need this in some areas. So I appreciate your consideration on this. Again, I think it's long overdue.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Mr. Chairman, your comment about cold climate prompted me to think about energy savings in the operations of homes. And I don't know, through the chair, if the home builders have calculated how much the average home will save by building to a code versus potentially not building to a code. So we have consumer protection in the form of both quality of construction, but also reduction in utility prices. Is that something that you have calculated? Thank you.
Mr. Owens, if you heard that question.
I'm sorry, my reception isn't real good here. Do you mind repeating that? I'm sorry.
Sure. My question is, can you calculate an estimate of how much the average person might save if you're building a home to code in current Alaska best practices informed by cold climate versus building a home that is not to any code and presumably less well-insulated, sealed, et cetera? Sure.
Well, I think we can, calculate the savings through the ACORM program through Alaska Housing. The code has provisions in Chapter 11 that kind of follow what Alaska Housing is doing, but Alaska Housing's program and amendments add a substantial savings to energy, if that answers your question, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. A comment first and then a question. Certainly a home that's built with better insulation to higher standards is going to have lower utility costs, but I heard a qualifier of best practices, so I would be cautious of drawing broad conclusions about that. But the question, which I haven't heard much of the discussion in the testimony yet, is what is the actual effect on the cost of a home that's built or repaired by somebody who has to appeal, adhere to a state residential building code? And I don't know, Mr. Owens, if you can address that or anybody else. I'll probably ask that question to several people.
It's really hard to compare a non-complying home to a home as far as cost goes in the initial build. But if it's done incorrectly and you have problems with the home, then there's a substantial cost to repair that home. And I think that's where the actual savings would come in. And, we have high winds, we have, high seismic zone. And I really think it's time that we have a minimum standard that the builders need to follow if they're going to do this. They're going to be in the building industry. They should follow a minimum standard. The minimum standard is the IRC, in my opinion.
Sure. Well, thank you. I understand certainly if a home is not built properly and it requires repair, that there are costs there, but there might be some initial reduction in the cost of a home that was not built in accordance with the residential building code. So I'm just wondering if you or anybody else can offer any estimation as to what that cost differential might be.
Yeah, I'm sure that a home built to code would cost a little bit more, if that answers your question.
I'll probe more folks to try and find out how much a little bit more might be, but thank you for that.
And just through the chair, Representative Sather, for clarification, if this particular bill pertains to general contractors, if you want to build your own personal private home, you do not have to adhere by the state residential building codes. But this is a way for the profession to have an even playing field as a starting line. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. This might be to the chair. It's kind of an unrelated question to what we've talked about so far. But in section one on page two, line two of the bill, we talk about passing a residential contractor examination to be offered by the department at least once each year. And I'm just curious, from the perspective of folks in the home building industry, if once a year is often enough to offer examination or if it should be offered more frequently in order to allow existing contractors and additional contractors to get into the industry and have that perspective on code. Or if you can elaborate on the once a year part.
I would say that would represent at least a minimum. There already is a residential contractor endorsement, and there's already tests offered, and I believe they are. I mean, it's been a long time since I took mine, but I believe they're offered more than once a year presently, and I would expect they would still be offered more than once a year. So,
thanks.
So we will set this bill aside, and we will move on, in the interest of time, to House Bill 149 from Representative Prox. We set. Thank you, Mr. Menard, and thank you to the invited testimony. We set an amendment deadline to this bill, and we received 15 amendments. We're going to talk about those now. If we don't get to all the amendments today, we will carry them over to Friday's meeting. So, first up, we Representative Carrick, do you have an amendment?
Yes. I move, Mr. Chair, are these amendments numbered in our packet, or should I just refer to them as S dot?
We'll refer to the work order, the S dot number, please, Representative Carrick.
All right. Then in that case, I move amendment S dot 4.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear which number, please.
S dot 4.
4. Thank you.
Okay. Representative, I objected. Carrick, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Amendment S dot 4 is an amendment that came about after attempting to draft this amendment a little bit differently, and being told from Ledge Legal that in order to draft the original amendment, I would be offering an amendment that would violate the compact. Essentially, my goal here is to ensure that our high-quality standards for Alaska licensure are not at any time violated by the requirements set for licensure with the NLC. So this amendment requires the Board of Nursing to report to the legislature immediately if they determine that the requirements of the Nurse License Compact licensure do not meet or exceed our Alaska individual state nurse licensure requirements. So just to provide a little more context, I initially wanted to draft this amendment to have trigger language to say that if the NLC standards at any time fell below those of Alaska nurse licensure requirements, that we would automatically no longer be a part of the NLC compact. And it's a red flag for me that we don't have state sovereignty on exiting the NLC without doing a repealer. So although it's not exactly what I was initially looking for, this amendment still serves an important function. It gives us a data point for the legislature if we choose to come back at any point and reevaluate our participation in the compact, which I believe we should do in the event that the standards offered from the NLC are not at the same high standard that we currently expect for Alaska's licensure.
Representative Prox, unless Representative Fields wishes to speak. Well, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. I'm not sure that this is necessary. I would think that if that indeed happened and it was material, somebody is going to report it to us, us being the legislature, and we can get out of that contract at any point. And so I don't think that the reporting is necessary myself, but I think it would be appropriate to defer to the department that has much more expertise on this than I do and get their opinion.
Sylvan Robb with...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Carrick's concern, so because the compact language will be adopted into statute in AS 0868-500, the only way it could be changed is through action taken by the Alaska legislature. So in the instance that the governing body, the Commission for the Nurse Licensure Compact, determined that they wanted to make a change to the compact, that would only become valid at such time that all the party states adopted that. So if they made a change that Alaska found concerning, the legislature could just not adopt that change, at which point we would fall out of the compact automatically with no action.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. I am still offering Amendment S.4 because I do have serious concerns about the situation where the commission meets and some aspect of the compact changes, particularly the standards for licensure. I want the, and I misspoke earlier, in this amendment, the Board of Nursing actually has 30 days to report those specific changes to the legislature. So it's not exactly immediately. But I do believe that there's great value in having feedback quickly on any changes that are made relevant to licensure requirements with the NLC.
Representative Fields.
I think I've heard enough discussion to withdraw my objection.
Okay, seeing... Okay, we have objection. Representative Ruffridge, would you like to speak to your objection?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Brocks?
No.
Representative Ruffridge?
No.
Representative Sadler?
Pass.
Representative Wright?
No.
Representative Carrick?
Yes.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
Yes.
And Chair Sumner?
Yes. Okay, so with four yays and three nays, Amendment S.4, which we will refer to as Amendment Number 1, has passed. Representative Fields, do you have an amendment to offer? We cannot refer to that. Or
no, we can't refer to that as amendment.
Okay. Yeah, so we will refer to that as Amendment Number 1. Representative Fields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in lieu of S.5, Representative Carrick may be offering S.23, which is basically an updated draft. So I will not be moving S.5 at this time.
And for the record, S.5 we will refer to as Amendment Number 2, even though it is not offered. We have an S.8, Representative Fields, which would be Amendment Number 3.
Mr. Chair, if it is your intent to offer a sunset, I will be deferring to you on a sunset amendment and not offering S.8 at this time.
Okay, Amendment Number 3 is not offered. We have an S.10, Representative Fields. That would be Amendment Number 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will move S.10.
Okay. Object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see some promise with increasing the ability of healthcare employers to onboard healthcare workers. My primary concern with the Nurse License Compact is it would weaken employees' bargaining position to ensure good wages and benefits in negotiations with employers. And this amendment would substantially resolve that concern and actually resolve my primary concern with the bill by restricting employers' ability to bring in new Nurse License Compact employees after strike notice has been given in the event of a strike. So that's what the amendment would do. It's worth noting what the amendment would not do. The amendment would not say that NLC nurses in general couldn't come into a state for other employers during a strike. It would not restrict the ability of previously admitted NLC nurses to continue working in a given facility. All it would do is prevent strike breaking by essentially a large block of NLC nurses after strike notice has been given. I think this bill really raises the question, why is there a nurse shortage? What can we do to address it? I think when we look at the evidence, a lot of the nurse shortage is driven not actually primarily by a lack of nurses coming in, but more nurse burnout. And that's true in all states, but why are nurses burning out? Low staffing, hard work, certainly maybe work that became harder over the last few years for some reasons outside our control. But I think if we're going to resolve the workforce shortage, nursing has to be a job that you can do sustainably. We also have to increase our workforce pipeline. So if we weaken nurses and, in the case of unionized employers, unions' ability to bargain for good wages and benefits and safe working conditions, we would perversely make hospitals a worse place to work and aggravate the burnout problem. I don't want to aggravate the burnout problem. I want nursing to be as good of a job as possible. It's actually, at this point, kind of a cornerstone for our middle class, the way that the health industry has developed. I also want to note there are existing federal protections that in the event of a strike, patients will be taken care of. So that's not necessary to deal with in this amendment because there's existing law on that. So happy to answer any questions, and thanks for your consideration.
Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would be opposed to this. As was pointed out, there's federal laws that get in the middle of a strike if it involves, I suppose, healthcare facilities. Also, we had a letter from the multi-state licensure board. It's on a white piece of paper. I'm sorry, I can't find it right now. But anyway, the folks from the multi-state licensure board thought that this would not comply with the multi-state compact, and we also have a letter that from Ledge Legal that, well, the quote is, this amendment could potentially violate the terms of the multi-state nursing licensure compact because it could be viewed as a material alteration to the terms. So I think adopting this would have the effect of defeating the purpose of the bill, and I don't know of a strike. I can't think back when there was a strike in Alaska of a nursing facility. I don't think it is a big risk that that would happen. If a strike does happen, we've got to keep the hospital open somehow, I would think. So I really recommend against adopting this amendment. Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I did just want to let committee members know I emailed a Ledge Legal memo on this notion of the compact because I sent that letter from the NLC lawyer. So we received a letter from an NLC lawyer. Obviously, that lawyer has a vested interest in this. I sent that to Ledge Legal. Ledge Legal sent a memo back, and Ledge Legal's guidance to me is, some of this is theoretical, it would have to be tested, but the test is the NLC has adopted substantially similar. And, you know, my argument would be strikes aren't frequent. The ability to strike is necessary to uphold wages and working conditions across industries, but I would argue that since we haven't had a strike that actually had to be carried out in healthcare in some time, certainly it is substantially similar and actually, to me, strengthens the bill. So I think it's fair to say that there are differing legal opinions on that. Thank you.
And I would have to add that I find it hard to see how allowing the wholesale import of out-of-state nurses in the event of Alaskan nurses striking would benefit workers in Alaska. And I suppose that the letter from the NLC I found a little bit troubling in that they're essentially saying that we cannot, in their opinion, pass any sort of restrictions around nurse licensure outside of the compact. And I would question that, you know, this I think would be oblique enough to the actual compact that it ought to survive. And if not, then all the statements about state sovereignty start to concern me that perhaps they reiterated it so many times because it may not be true. So Representative Fox.
Yes, thank you. And the other point, I think that this sort of language would be unique to the profession of nursing, or, you know, if you will, the license of nursing. I don't know, perhaps Ms. Robb could fill us in on, again, the department's viewpoint on this and whether we have that provision in other areas of state law.
For the record, Sylvan Robb. Through the chair to Representative Prox, I am not familiar with all elements of state law. Those statutes that cover the 125 professions that are regulated by the division, none of them contain similar strike language. Additionally, I think in terms of concerns about state sovereignty related to this, as Representative Prox noted, it was the legal counsel for the NLC who indicated that he feels that this would be a material deviation. And the compact is a contract between states, and so changing what licensees, multi-state licensees from one state are entitled to in another state is a deviation from that contract. And when you think about the fact that it's unchangeable, that is actually what makes the compact so strong and gives the division and the Board of Nursing and the administration and the members of AHA who are supportive such confidence in the nurse licensure compact because those rules are unchanging. So there's no wiggle room around the edges for someone to decide that they would like to change the requirements to ease up a little bit in something. So that is both a restriction on our behavior, but also a guarantee that we are getting in how other states will behave.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. I would just say that to some significant degree, this amendment, if adopted, would treat state-only, or what I call siloed nurses, licensed nurses, and those licensed under the Interstate Compact differently in a fairly significant way. And as such, it would appear contrary to the basic justification for the bill. So I will maintain my objection to it.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I just want to follow up on Representative Sadler's comment just now. I think the basic justification for this legislation is to ensure that folks are able to get to work more quickly in Alaska and that licensed nurses that are part of the compact are able to work in Alaska, not necessarily to wholesale bring in many nurses in order to break a strike. I see this amendment, number four, as essentially getting to the crux of some of the concerns around this legislation while still allowing for the compact language to remain essentially unchanged and to still address some of the major challenges that the NLC is trying to address. So I would certainly encourage folks to support this amendment.
Okay. So there is objection. Please call the roll.
Representative Fields.
Yes.
Representative Props.
No.
Representative Ruffridge.
No.
Representative Sadler.
No.
Representative Wright.
No.
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Chair Sumner.
Yes. And so with 3 yeas and 4 nays, amendment number 4 has failed.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
3 yeas, 4 nays. I counted backwards. Yes. Is that what it was?
Representative Prox, it was 3 yeas and 4 nays, and the amendment fails.
Oh.
And we have run out of time for the day. So we will set House Bill 149 aside. Amendments will be carried over, and we will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:17 p.m.